This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
For over 30 years, she has been the reason our children have gone to bed on time, the reason many pledges make it into college fraternities. She has been a Halloween fairy tale, a dare between youngsters. She was often used to prompt our children into an undesired task, much like a favorite ghost story. She was often the first real challenge of youthful friendship, or the obstacle faced by an incoming Georgetown College freshman under a midnight moon. And she has been called the Tent Girl. Hey there, pod people. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Through the Abyss. I'm your co-host, Mandy.
And I am your co-host, Ben.
And today we are talking about, it's actually a really fascinating topic because it's part urban legend and it's part true crime and it's part Jane Doe found her identity. It's just a lot of really interesting topics all related, wrapped up into one lovely story. And it's also kind of a pinnacle case because it was the first time the internet was able to solve a missing persons case, which we'll get into a little bit later.
Yeah, kind of revamped how things are done in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Definitely helped things for sure. So what we're talking about today, again, is the Tent Girl. Her name is Barbara Ann Hackman. Her family and close friends called her Bobby. Now, I think she had a just normal childhood life, so nothing really drastic that needs to be reported on that or anything. But
I'm the oldest sister of seven children. Growing up, we lived in a two-room house, no running water. We had a well and an outhouse. We didn't have cell phones and things like that. We were lucky to get a used bike somewhere.
When she was in her teens, she met this guy named George Earl Taylor. He was a carny doing the travel around thing. Basically, she started out as his babysitter because he had a kid. And while she was babysitting, of course, they got close or whatever. And he had told her that his wife had left him and his kid for another man. A few months later, they actually married and they had a few kids.
My sister Bobby was a very well manicured young lady. Bobby had brown hair. She would tease it, spray it, manicure her nails. She was very nicely dressed. She was just beautiful. And at Bobby's age, I think she was ready to get out of the house.
As far as working and everything, she actually joined the carnival with him.
He was young at this time, correct? She was 19-ish?
Oh, yeah, she was still in her teens.
And how old was he?
I am not 100% sure. I don't think he was...
He was older, though.
He was older, yeah, but I mean, not like crazy dad issues older, so as far as I know. So when she joined the carnival, they actually moved to Florida to the carnival's home base. So they lived down there for a while. And her mom and her sister moved down to Florida with her to help with the kids and, you know, to be near and everything. Now, George was able to get her sister work at the carnival's home base. I think she was kind of like a secretary or something, you know, just did the paperwork and things like that. One day, George and Bobby show up at her sister's work. They were trying to sell her a TV. And Bobby stated that they had to leave for a while because apparently George went AWOL from the military and the FBI was looking for him. And I guess they were in town. So of course they're freaking out, which that's a whole nother story there. Now they left, they were gone for months and months. No word to Bobby's family. Sister's friend says that she had seen George in Davie, Florida, and he told her that Bobby had left him for another man. Typical stories. Seems to be repetitive with this gentleman. Her sister went down to Davey. She wanted to actually confront him, but obviously didn't have his address or anything like that. So she goes to the Davey cops, and coincidentally, and luckily, I should say, George had just been pulled over, so the cops were able to give the sister his address. So sister goes over him, over to where he lives, confronts him. He tells her the exact same story that Bobby had run off and left him and her kids for another man. And he absolutely refuses to tell Bobby's sister where the kids are.
I wonder what the protocol is as far as like the police giving her his address. Like, I wonder what story she presented to them, because if she came at them with the truth, which is I'm worried about my sister, she's missing, so mm-hmm. I want to go confront this person who is definitely the last person with her. Mm-hmm. That sounds terrifying. I feel like the police would steer you away from that and they would go address it themselves. However, if she just said, I just need this guy's address, I feel like the police should protect his privacy.
I don't know, because I thought about that too. I'm assuming Davey might be like a smaller community. And, you know, if her sister told them the story that, you know, she hasn't seen or talked to her sister in a few months and she has no way to get in contact with, you know, George, I don't know, maybe they took pity on her. Maybe when they pulled him over, there was something that they just thought was shady about him. I don't know, but
And I could see that. But then wouldn't you say, hey, why don't we go with you? Or why don't you let us go talk to him? I just wouldn't let this woman just go talk to this guy who's possibly involved with someone's disappearance. Well, I mean, they don't know of a disappearance per se at that point. But they do know that they haven't had contact with this person for a long time. The sister.
I don't know. I mean, maybe her sister was just very convincing, you know, or maybe it's a case of the Davey cops just, and forgive me for saying this, just didn't feel like dealing with it. So like, here's the address.
Yeah, they probably thought take care of what you wanted. This couple just went off, and I'm sure that her sister's fine, and it's her brother-in-law. Give her the address. Be done with it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you on.
It didn't seem like the protocol was correct.
Right. Yeah. Like, because I can't imagine the cops giving out somebody's address like that. I mean,
no, I would be I don't know under what circumstances somebody might be looking for like you or I. But if you think about it, everything from a personal level, right? If someone just randomly went to the police and was like, hey, I want Benjamin Dallas Jones's address. Right. Like, which you can look up online. You can find it anyways.
Right.
You know, exactly. It is what it is. But, you know, pre-internet, I mean, not that this was pre-internet, but when internet was raw and you didn't have every address on there, I wouldn't want them to just give all my personal information to whoever they feel like.
This is pre-internet, by the way, right now.
It is pre-internet. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it would be for sure.
Yeah, it's in the 60s.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we lived pre-internet. So yes.
Yes. Yes. High school. I think my senior year of high school is when the internet really came to fruition and people are starting to use email and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I didn't know how big it was going to be.
Oh gosh. I wish I would have put stock in something. I don't know. Yes. But it's, I don't know. Maybe it's not because it's not like a HIPAA violation where they're giving out medical information or like that. Maybe it's not something that's forbidden. I mean, I would question something like that before I, you know, because I mean, she could be putting her life in danger.
Going right, that's what herself. I'm saying is like, because her story to them was probably like, I'm terrified about what's going on with my sister. I haven't heard from her forever. I hear this guy's down here by himself saying that she left him. She would have definitely come and spoken to me and my mother, and my other sister. She wouldn't have just disappeared. So I'm very frightened. I want this guy's address so I can go confront him. Like, if I was a police officer, I'd be like, sounds unsafe, right? Like, if your story is correct and something did go awry, I don't want to send another woman to this person who's potentially dangerous.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you on that. But apparently Davey Cops didn't think about that because, you know, they gave her his address and even told her that he'd just been pulled over, which
also is information that probably is not allowed to occur.
Well, I mean, although it might be in the papers. Yeah, I mean, stuff like that is public record, I would assume.
Yeah, it just seems it was just all real flippant. It's like, oh, that guy, we just pulled him over yesterday. He was doing this and that. It's like, okay, I guess you guys just say whatever.
Yeah, it's weird. And I thought about that too. So after he's just being a complete dick and won't tell her, you know, where her nieces are, she goes back to the cops to file a missing persons report. And, you know, then she goes back home. She tells her mom what had happened. Her mom wants to go down and talk to George too. So they drive back to Davie. And I'm not talking like a week or two later, like it was like immediate from what I understand. They drive back to Davie. Dude has disappeared completely. Like everything he has is packed up and gone. Kids, nothing's there. And from that point on, they never see or hear from him again. Now, this is where Tent Girl comes into play. The name anyway, I should say. May 17th, 1968, Wilbur Riddle, he was off US 25, which is near Georgetown, Kentucky, looking for glass insulators, which, do you know what those are, by the way? They're these little glass tops that are put on top of, like, well, a long time ago, they used to be put on top of, like, electric poles and stuff like that. And for whatever reason, people collect them. My grandma actually used to collect them. She has a few of them.
Because I guess they watch a lot of, what is it? Not Storage Wars, but American Pickers. American Pickers is a very good show for anyone that wants to see a catchy one. But I do remember them talking about these things, this glass insulators at one point. But I didn't think too much of it till now. Yeah.
Yeah. So people collect them. My grandma did. I mean, they're just like little bowl, glass bowls. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he was going down looking for them. Because apparently they just, I guess whoever, when they get rid of them, they just chucked them wherever. And, you know, people go look for them and everything. So he was down there. He noticed a green bag on the hillside that he was at. So he, you know, was curious and walked over to see what it was. And he kind of, I guess he was a little hesitant to touch it. So he kind of moved it with his foot, which made it roll down the hill and kind of open up a little bit. And when he went down there, he sees it's a human body. He called the sheriff, Bobby Vance. And when sheriff got there, they discovered that the body was a female. She was nude. She was in a fetal position. She was badly decomposed, like so much that her eyes were gone. They had to rehydrate her fingers to get any kind of prints, and she had no matching dental records. But there was like kind of like a little split in between her front two teeth that was, you know, a little bit different. I guess you could say something that wouldn't may stand out from other things. She didn't have any kind of identification on her at all. So of course she became a Jane Doe. And later, I guess the media or whatever dubbed her the Tent Girl because she was wrapped up in this canvas tent like bag. And apparently it's, you know, the kind of tent stuff that they use in carnivals, which I don't think they realized that right off the bat because George technically was never convicted of anything ever, which is ridiculous to me, but you know, so she goes to autopsy. They determine that she's 5'1", between 16 and 18, and that she had been dead between 2 weeks and 2 months. Now, remember, this is in the 60s, so there's no like really, really good forensics. So it pretty much kind of didn't exist.
I'm interested in the phrase rehydrated her fingers to get the prints. I assume that's just maybe as simple as soaking her hand in water.
No, or I think is that they like actually an actual inject. Process?
Okay.
Yeah, they inject. I don't think it's water. I think it's some kind of a type of a chemical that will rehydrate the skin where you can get actual prints off of it.
Yeah, that's a technology I hadn't heard before. So that's interesting.
Yeah, they still do it today.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's probably a lot more high tech than it was back then, but whatever they did worked. I mean, they got her fingerprints, but you know, there was no luck with that. Now with this area, and I used to live around this area, my mom and stepdad actually used to live in Georgetown, Kentucky. And, you know, I went to school down in Lexington, college. I went to UK for a while and lived in a little town called Midway, which is doesn't even have, they have a post office, but there's like no mailboxes. So you have to get your mail at the post office. Super, super tiny town. So obviously the police for this particular type of crime, they didn't feel that they were able to really make leaps and bounds with it. So they called the state police in.
It was a small town. I think 5,000 people lived in it. Very seldom we ever had a murder. It was mainly just husband and wife fighting or teenagers. It just never happens around here.
Now, as far as fingerprint records go, this is before they had the online databases, obviously. So they are literally have to physically go through fingerprint records, like because they're on cards or whatever. I can't even imagine having to go through that and looking at her fingerprints and comparing them to something else that's on a note card or whatever the hell they put use for it. But they went through everything and came back with no luck, which not surprising.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, like, unless you were a criminal and back then, like, we've obviously been fingerprinted multiple times for jobs and things like that.
Right.
But just a random, like, 17, 18 year old girl wouldn't have her fingerprints on file for anything for the most part, right?
There's no reason to. They didn't even have that, you know, fingerprint your kids to keep them on file in case they go up missing. I mean,
none of that
existed. There's nothing. It's just your fingerprints on a card, a piece of paper, which, you know, thank God forensics are a lot better now.
Yes.
Now, you know, they're basically hitting a ton of roadblocks. So there was a cop who was actually an artist and he did a sketch of her, you know, based off of autopsy files.
Sounds like that would be an extremely difficult job based on the description of the body.
I would think so. I mean, if she didn't have eyes, I don't know. I mean, and for, I don't know. I can't, well, I'll put a picture up of the one that they have, because they actually put it on a gravestone that they had erected for her.
Yeah.
But I mean, it could have been anyone, honestly. It's one of those that aren't like, you see it and you're like, oh my God, that is whoever. Like, it's not something that you jump out to you and say. And actually it caused a problem with another family who thought it was their daughter who had been missing, I think for like 6 months or something. She was 16 or whatever. And so, you know, this is for before DNA and everything. So they were convinced that Bobby was their daughter, and they, you know, went to Kentucky and actually, I think they let them see the body and they're like, yeah, I think this is our daughter. So they go home, they start planning a funeral for their daughter. Well, I guess they got some kind of anonymous phone call that said, no, your daughter's alive. And she's, I think, in Pennsylvania. So that was another case that was solved, you know.
Yeah.
Her daughter and her boyfriend ran off.
It's horrible that that mistake was made, but it's,
oh God, yeah,
it obviously worked out for them. It's much better that your daughter ran off and is alive than.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So.
And glad we found that out too, because then Bobby probably never would have been identified. It would have just been, you know,
because they would have had a funeral. It would have been a done deal.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, absolutely. So that was, whoever made that anonymous phone call is awesome. They really, really helped out with that. So yeah, the police are pretty much, case goes cold. She was buried in an unmarked grave, and a little bit later, the funeral home donates a headstone, and it had her picture on it and had kind of, it had her description. It had the date that she was found.
When you say her picture, you mean the composite, the picture?
Yeah, the composite artist? Drawing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The composites drawing of her. So that was in the Georgetown Cemetery. Still is, by the way. It's 30 years later. This is where we get a lot more information. For some reason, I guess, I think George had cancer and he was dying, and he actually gave his kids information to where they could reach out to their mom's sister, because I don't know if he had
I think we're really lucky in this case. I feel that the kids were alive. right? Because when they when the sister first runs up to George, right, like obviously the kids are nowhere to be seen either. Mm-hmm. So it's like with this guy's history, you never know what happened to them. So thank goodness they were okay.
It is weird because, I mean, I'm 100% convinced he's a serial killer because he killed all his wives.
Yeah.
Because he has the same damn explanation. But, you know, it's weird to think that he would keep his kids around with him, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. But luckily, I guess he has some kind of a heart. Mandy.
This is speculation, not speculation, but just random thoughts that pop in my head. So, you know, this is going to turn bad. But is it possible to be a serial killer and a great father?
Yeah, I mean, I think BTK's daughter said he was a good guy.
I say BTK was like married children, and he was like one of the deacons or whatever at his church where he was very highly respected. He was the guy that you would invite to like your Sunday bunch.
John Wayne Gacy, too. I mean, he wasn't a great husband, but I mean, he was like a pillar of the community. I mean, he was, you know, politically, he was kind of a big guy.
Yeah. Some of these guys are able to like compartmentalize what they do.
They would have to.
Parts of their lives. Yeah.
You would have to. I mean, especially somebody like BTK, because he didn't have a problem torturing and killing kids, because that was like one of his first ones was the little girl. So. Right.
But being like a deacon in his church, you assume he actually was a believer. And just to put this out there, I mean, for the people that aren't Christians, you know, necessarily, just to let everyone know, murdering people is not one of the Christian pillars, right? Like, especially children. So,
believe the Ten Commandments, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, he'd really have to be compartmentalizing his life if he was like a believer and he's big in his church. He's got his family relatively happy, and then he's doing these just horrendously horrific things. I don't know how he could seam those all together and not just, I don't know. I don't know how these people, I wanted to say not lose your mind, but clearly he has lost his mind, but how you can look like a functioning normal person and have that.
Well, that seems to be and you should probably know better on this than I do, that that's kind of one of the traits of a psychopath, you know.
Yeah.
They can integrate into anything. They're very manipulative.
Well, and that's how you become a serial killer. Clearly, obviously, if you were very blatantly, obviously bizarre, right?
Yeah.
Which some of them are, and some of them get caught that way, where they're like, this guy's a little bit off. But the way these real, like Ted Bundy, they say he's super nice, super charismatic. Women loved him. He was a beautiful dude, right?
I wouldn't go that far, but well,
people say he was attractive. He was able, with his personality and his looks, he was able to make a presentable dude, right?
He was charming and intelligent.
Right. So those factors are what allows them to get away with it for so long, because no one thinks these people did it, right? Like BTK, like his life just doesn't reflect what a serial killer's life should reflect. So you're never going to look at him.
Yeah. That's like with, I think, all of the serial killers for the most part. I mean, you know, they talk to their neighbors and stuff like that after they've been caught. They're like, I never would have suspected that for a second, you know.
Yeah.
They may be a little bit weird, but, you know, like Dahmer, his neighbor that lived across from him, she had absolutely no idea. He thought he was a regular, you know, young guy.
Yeah. The Times Square killer, I believe, is the one that I've seen recently where that guy was weird.
Well, Ed Gein was weird, but he still got away with it.
So there are some, but there's some that just like you would never, ever suspect ever.
You know, Ed Gein, though, I don't really classify him as a serial killer, because I have to go back and check my notes on this, but I don't think he killed more than three people. He dug up bodies and used corpses for all kinds of crazy shit, but I don't know. It's weird. Yeah. But back to Bobby. I love how we go off on our tangent sometimes. So George's kids actually reach out to Rosemary, Bobby's sister, and she told them, or they told her that, and this is the oldest daughter, she said that they had went to Kentucky and they were all living in a one-bedroom apartment. And the oldest daughter says that she had woken up one night to her parents struggling. And again, this is all like from what I watched on Who Killed Jane Doe, season two, I think it's episode one or two. If you guys want, you should watch it because it's really good. It's very informative. But the oldest daughter said that she woke up and they were struggling, but she didn't do anything and didn't say anything because she didn't want to get in trouble. So basically she just went back to sleep. But in the morning, mom was gone. And George had told them that her mom left them for another man. The same old story. So
I feel bad for George. He keeps getting left for all these other men.
Yeah, what the hell's wrong with this guy, right? They hate him so much they dump their kids too. Yeah, so this dude, God.
Now, did they have kids together or were these his kids that she... Okay, so
he had... I think it was... God, my memory is so awful. He had a kid and then she had... I think he had a daughter and then they had another daughter together.
Okay.
So, yeah, so they one from a previous marriage and then they had some together as well. Now, Wilbur, the man who found Bobby in the tent, in the canvas tent wrap up, he talked about the case a lot, especially to his daughter's boyfriend, Todd Matthews. So Todd kind of became obsessed with the case and he pretty much gathered up everything he could find on the case. This is where the internet comes into play. So while Todd's gathering up information and creating this fantastic network called the Doe Network, it's DOENetwork.com. Any kind of true crime or web sleuths, go on this and you will be lost in it for hours because it's very addictive. It's wonderful. So that's one of the wonderful things that came out of Bobby's death. But at the same time, he's compiling a bunch of lists and everything. Rosemary is also posting on forums, you know, because back then we, you know, there's a lot of forums that people would chit chat in or whatnot. So she was posting on forums and everything. And Todd happened to come across some of Rosemary's posts and they end up talking with each other. And she tells him her sister's story. And Todd was like, this is too coincidental. It's too familiar. And I think you should probably reach out to the cops down here and tell them about it. So she calls the cops and give them, you know, the description. They tell her that they don't have any matching descriptions, whatever. So Todd tells her again to call them back and to ask about Tent Girl. So she kind of goes back and forth with the cops and they eventually bring in a forensic anthropologist who compares Bobby's pics to the autopsy pics. And he concluded that the bone and teeth structure were so similar that he wanted to have the body exhumed. So they exhumed her body and DNA is taken from her and also from Rosemary, her sister. Well, it turns out that it's a match. So, you know, Tent Girl is now Barbara Ann Hackey, aka Bobby. So she's finally identified and they actually erected a new headstone next to the original one in Georgetown, Kentucky. I really just love this case because so many wonderful things came out of it. Like we solved one missing girl, you know, who ran off and of course mom didn't know anything about it. So that one was solved. And then the Tent Girl's true identity was solved because of the internet and because of, you know, Rosemary never giving up and Todd being so invested in it. And he eventually, and Todd is, as you'll hear in a little while, because we actually sat down and chatted with him for a bit. He's an awesome, awesome guy. He is a co-founder of the Doe Network, as I said, and he worked for the Department of Justice for a little while and also came up with the NamUs website, which is kind of different. One's more federal and the other's, well, I'll let him, you'll hear his description of it, but it's actually, I really, really enjoyed chatting with him. I mean, he's a wealth of knowledge and, you know, very good with all the missing data and everything like that. It's, you know, they, because of his creation of this website, they have solved a lot of, you know, Jane Doe's, they've come up with their identity and everything. And it's really wonderful. And I know if you've actually looked at this website and you're into true crime and web sleuths and, you know, missing people, that I'm sure you probably found it as fascinating as I did.
Yeah, no, Todd was awesome, very gracious with his time. He had a ton of information. It was very, very cool hearing from him. And he's got a lot going on, right, which we talk about in the interview with him. So make sure you're checking into the things he's doing futuristically and the things he's got currently going on, because they're amazing and very informative, as Mindy said.
Definitely, definitely. Can you just go over kind of your part in this whole story?
Okay, so well, Tent Girl began, and I'm sure my wife, she's with me right now, she's heard this story so many times, she's had to live it. But her dad found the body of the Tent Girl in 1968 in Scott County, Kentucky, and that's where Lori was born. And that was before she was born. So it was something she kind of grew up with. She would hear the story over. He found her wrapped in a canvas tent wrapper, and that's where she got the name, the nickname Tent Girl. And I think it's very fortunate because it stuck. It kind of gave her an identity beyond not having an identity. You know, right. She wasn't just Jane Doe. That's, you'll see so many John and Jane Doe's get an extra name. And, you know, usually it's the location or a certain condition in which they're found. So, but it stood out, you know, and they moved to Overton County, Tennessee back in 1987. It was October. And, you know, just the normal kids getting to know each other, talking. It was Halloween time of the year, and she told me the story of the Tent Girl. It just seemed familiar, and we were married by next July. Her house burned and her family moved back to Kentucky, and I kept Lori. You know, Lori stayed behind. We already made up our mind what we were going to do, so she stayed behind. We got married about a year earlier than we planned on, but it worked out. It's been about 34 years now, so I think I'll keep her. Maybe she'll keep me. I don't know. She threatens a lot, but I think she's more talk. But, you know, Lori seemed familiar to me. The Tent Girl story seemed familiar to me. So, you know, and this is before the internet. We're young, married. Basically, it was trips because nothing's digitized. It was, and that's the problem with a lot of John and Jane Doe cases right now. If they're not digitized, you can't search them online. Even if there was an internet, there was no way to search these. It was physically going to libraries, newspapers to try to get copies of stories that might have had something different in it. So it's gather and sort. Sort of what we do at the Doe Network is gather the information, sort it, and then try to present it. Okay. I spend more time trying to collect information and present it than I actually do trying to solve a case. In particular, I think saving that data is really important. And the Tent Girl was the first time that was ever done. That's why her case was really important, because it was the first case solved by using the internet. And I think there was an interesting twist that it was my own father-in-law that found the body. It kind of kept it in the family.
Yeah.
So it just made the story stick, you know, and her having her unique nickname. She had a tombstone with her likeness on it that we visited several times. Mm-hmm. And during this time, Rosemary was finding her two nieces. When the Tent Girl's husband, Barbara Taylor's husband, when he was dying the same month and year that I found out about the Tent Girl, October of 87, he gave the daughters enough information to find their mother's sister. So they were able to find each other. So they had already started putting together pieces of their story, and they were looking for her online, and I was looking from the other way. So it's just a matter of time before we finally ran into each other. You know, I would look for, you know, I put the information online, so I had a Tent Girl website, but I thought, okay, they'll see it. Somebody will see it, and they'll respond, and then they didn't. So it was, again, a search. They had posted a note about Barbara on a Crane and Hibbs website. It was the Craigslist of the day, but it was called Crane and Hibbs. Wow. I knew it when I saw it, that it was her. They had described her last known to be in Lexington, Kentucky, and Georgetown, where she was found, as a suburb of Lexington. So it was clearly that was her. And I knew her height. I knew everything about her except her name. And then I saw Rosemary's listing, and I reached out to her, and we made contact. And luckily, I didn't have to say, your sister's an urban legend in Kentucky. I had a website, and I just basically, here, just look at this.
Yeah.
And I know it probably seems so strange, because they were hoping to find her alive. And then not only is her sister dead, she's been murdered. She's an urban legend with ghost stories around it in Kentucky.
Yeah.
That had to be a shocker, you know, to them. But, you know, after all of those years, you know, it took over 10 years. And I thought that was going to be the end of it. But here I am today, 51, and we're still talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
Just,
I mean, it's
just from 17 to 51. You know, I had no idea. I thought we would put a name on her grave. She would be, you know, her family knows where she's at, and the whole world would forget about it. I had no idea that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's fabulous. I mean, it's because of her that you came up with the Dove Network, right?
Yes. And actually, I had, and I've got a newspaper article that I'll share with you. In 1998, right afterwards, there was an about.com guy there in Lexington that I met up with, and, you know, she published some of her stories. So we decided then that we were going to create a website, myself, Rosemary, and the two daughters, Bonnie and Shelley. We wanted to create a website for Kentucky in particular first, and then later the United States, for missing and unidentified persons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they kind of fell off. They didn't, you know, it takes web skills. So other volunteers kind of got on board, and ultimately the product was called the Doe Network, and it worked. People said it's impossible that that won't work, but it did. You know, more cases were solved. And a lot of the earlier cases were the low-hanging fruit. They were the cases where it's pretty obvious that that person's that person. We've just never been able to digitally share this data. And you can't Google a filing cabinet. If it's not there, you know, if it's not available, it's not available. So those were where some of the very first solves come from, is because the tool was there. And the cases were being digitized so that people could actually solve them.
Right.
And actually, they were not that difficult of solves. I mean, it would be 2 seconds today if you put them online. Some of those cases, it took a while, you know, for them to get saturated into the search engine so that people could see them. People were getting used to the archives so that they could come and look at the cases. They could search by year, state, any combination. I created a Chronodex and a Geodex, and that separated them by year, you know, age range that they were found, and maybe the state that they were found in.
Wow.
And that helped, or they went missing, and that was just a way to start categorizing them.
It's kind of an addictive website to browse around. I've been on it quite a bit lately, just looking, and it's very, very informative. And just the way you guys have it set up is just, it's perfect. It's wonderful.
Well, and I think a lot of people like the simple format of the Doe Network, and it's cheaper. You know, I spend about $300 a year paying for the website, actually. So it's not that expensive.
Oh, wow.
Now, NamUs cost millions, and it costs $7 million a year to run, basically, is what the cost is.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm not with NamUs any longer. That particular job that I had, it just no longer exists at NamUs. You know, the grant went to another organization, and it was kind of good timing for me. I mean, it's not a job that you can just walk away from and say, I'm not going to do it anymore. But in another way, it's a relief because, you know, I wanted to work in the entertainment industry and do television. And I start my own podcast next week with Morgan Freeman's company. And iHeartRadio.
That is really cool. Yeah,
because cool. I couldn't do that working for the Department of Justice. That would not have happened. I could not have done it.
Because of security issues, that type of thing?
Oh, well, it'd be a conflict of interest. Actually, they wanted, you know, I couldn't really work on Doe Network directly during the time that I was there too, because they're not competing entities. They're not. They don't work the same way. Doe Network uses anecdotal data that's found in newspaper articles, and NamUs uses biometrics. They use dental DNA fingerprints for the most part. They both publish cases online, but, you know, they asked me to help them to design the NamUs database and then operate it. And, you know, there was other things that we could use that Doe Network just can't use. So it's a different approach to the same end.
Wow.
But, you know, sometimes Doe Network can give cause, like NamUs, unless you're law enforcement, you don't see cause and manner of death in an unidentified body. That's something that's not a category that we could disseminate. But with Doe Network, we can, because often it was mentioned in the newspaper article that talked about the case. Say NamUs doesn't exactly house the newspaper articles or the text of the article. You know, it's all basically an autopsy report, you know, just very clinical data. But Doe Network has the luxury of telling more of the story. And I think a lot of the people like Doe Network better because they want to read the story.
Yeah, I mean, especially the web sleuths and true crimers, they definitely want to hear the story behind it. I know I do.
Yes. And I think, you know, when you're looking at it as a law enforcement tool, I think the interest in the story is just not logical. You know, that's not usually something, you know, and I had to devise a way of doing that. Like, you know, part of my interest was in the nitty gritty of the cases. But I realized that the science had to happen. So I felt like both entities should exist because they have very, very different functions. Again, to the same end, but they just do it so differently.
Right. Now, your podcast, is it on missing persons as well? Or Jane Doe,
it
that
is.
Type of thing?
It is. It's going to be, and we actually have an entire first season written out.
Oh, my
God. It goes slower than I like to go, you know, because I would like to do things with television, and I probably still will. We're still looking at some television formats where we're, you know, presenting cases and trying to get them resolved. Now, podcasts, they're more in a storytelling form.
Right.
So there was a case that a boy was missing. I won't give it all away. I will actually send you a PDF of an article that gives you the rest of the story. But he was missing for 45 years. His mother had given him away because his stepfather ended up being a serial killer. And he was already abusing the child that did not belong to him. He was an infant. She gave him away to a friend that had lost a baby, and then they disappeared. So when the boy turns, when his adoptive father passes away, his adoptive mother tells him his real name. He Google searches it, and he finds me and an article that I had on him on the Doe Network with my number. And he called me and said, "That's me." And it was him. So we had to go to Namus then to actually do the DNA. And then the comparison was correct. It was him. So that was a perfect marriage of a case that wasn't on Namus because it was mostly a story that we really couldn't confirm if an infant was actually missing. But once you see the PDF, you'll see it's a very interesting story. So the entire first season is going to be spent with him as of this moment. That's the plan, helping him discover who he would have been, who he is.
That is amazing.
And maybe even confronting a serial killer. The serial killer is already interviewed from our radio show. He just don't know it.
Oh, my God. So you actually talked to the serial killer himself?
Yes. More than 15 years ago, I wrote him a letter in prison trying to get him to tell me, you know, there was two missing boys.
Uh-huh.
And one of them found me. I didn't have to find him. He found me.
Oh, my God.
And then I have to tell him, well, by the way, I have actually been in contact with your stepfather that you never knew and probably didn't want to know. But can you imagine finding out that not only were you given away, that your stepfather was a serial killer, a very well-known serial killer, Franklin Floyd. I did a podcast before we called it podcast back in 2006 called Missing Pieces. And I was actually doing that when I got the call from the Department of Justice. Of course, you didn't get paid back then. There was really no way of getting paid to do it. I was just doing it because I was having all these wonderful phone calls with people that should have been recorded. So we did. I started recording them and transcribing them. So you were able to find them in a search engine so you could pick up stuff. And, you know, I had to quit that when I actually went to work for Department of Justice. I couldn't just keep conducting interviews. So I always kind of missed it, you know, and then this gave me an opportunity to kind of go back to it. And I've not been a big listener of podcasts, but, you know, all the young people, I substitute teach at school a lot now just to help the school system out because they can't get subs. These kids, that's all they listen to. I have them telling me, "I heard you on this podcast." And I thought, I don't even remember interviewing for that podcast. I don't even remember because I never heard it. I never even listened to it after I was done.
And it's a huge medium now. The podcast is.
Yeah, for sure.
I guess
anybody can do it.
Todd, what's the name of the new one?
There's been a working title, and they affectionately call it a podcast right now, but I'm really not sure what the final name's going to be set on, but the working title right now is a podcast.
Copy that.
I am super excited to hear this first season.
Yeah, 12 episodes. We've already got them wrote out with what I hope to accomplish during that particular thing, and we have a really well-known, it's a Neon Hum. It's the name of the podcast production company that's going to come on board. This is the first podcast that Revelations Entertainment, Morgan Freeman's company, has ever done.
Oh, wow.
So this is something it's all new. So I'm their guinea pig with them. We may have to do something else at the same time. And doing these with people like you, you know, I have an opportunity to broadcast things that I can't just put in a podcast. I won't have time.
Exactly. Yeah. And when I came across you, I was like, this is something I think we're going to have to get to know. Cause you just have such a love for this particular topic. And I do as well. And plus, you're a Tennessee boy. You're 45 minutes outside of my hometown, so I kind of love you for that.
Where was the town again? I forgot.
Cookeville.
Cookeville. Okay, we were heading home from Cookeville right now, and it's about 20 minutes.
Is it only 20 minutes?
I drove from Livingston, from Cookeville to Livingston during the time we were talking.
Oh my gosh! Okay.
So it's not been long at all.
Wow! It's so this whole new podcast and everything that you're doing now all stem from this tent girl, right?
Yes, really, it did. I mean, it was the catalyst. And literally, I mean, all these years later, and it's still something we talk about. it's one of the most requested stories. When I sub, they kind of let me do what I want to do.
Oh, nice.
Because I used to do a forensic thing with them. I would go and do a forensic lecture and tell them about the ologies, odontology, anthropology. You know, I wasn't any of those things, but I employed those people to help us, you know, put the cases into NamUs and, you know, review the autopsy reports. So I'd at least know how to use those people, whether I'd done it myself or not. Wow. And when COVID hit, there was no outside speakers.
Right.
So when you become a substitute teacher, you're not an outside speaker. So it's just a good opportunity. So I mostly do the upper grades. And then, you know, but once we went through it, you kind of exhausted it. You know, you get called back. They'll always ask me, well, tell us a story. And if they're good and the teacher is giving me alternatives so that I could do this or that, we will try to sit down and do that. And they are very well behaved. They like these stories.
I would love to have correspondence with a serial killer and do some kind of amazing thing, but I'm kind of afraid to write any of them, to be honest.
Well, we might actually, if we get permission, you know, the thought is maybe we should even go visit him, but you got to get the permission. He's got to be willing.
Yeah.
So I don't know what Carrick would have to offer him. But, you know, the chance that he might be able to go back and confront his own, you know, the man that made him go missing.
Oh, my God.
And to have him understand about his mom. You know, he said, originally he said, I think my mom threw me away like garbage. And I said, no, maybe she put Moses in a basket. Have you ever thought of that?
Right.
Right.
You know, so, wow. And I'm sure that was extremely difficult for her to have to do that. But, you know, how are things going to stand now? You know, like, is it possible that he could have a relationship with her now? And who has to let go? Is it something she's got to get used to? Or does he have to just kind of realize that things happen? There's nothing we can do about what happened then, but we can change it now. So, you know, we got a lot of unpacking to do on this particular case. And, you know, we'll be doing it in real time. I don't know. We've scripted out as much as I can. But as far as how it's going to unravel during each show, I don't know, you know.
Oh, that's exciting.
Well, it's took so long with the negotiations because it's a new thing. It is so difficult to get these set up. And it seems like there's always a delay. There's always another spike in COVID. There's something that's kept it from happening so many times. And it's just like we're about to start now. So hopefully the pedal will hit the metal and we'll move so fast I'll be tired.
Do you know when the first episode's actually going to air?
No, I don't even know when we're going to turn the microphone on. The pledge to make what turned out to be the Doe Network, I've got that original article that I'll share with you. And then I've looked back. There's so many old stories from like the 1990s where we resolved other cases. Amateurs were doing this. And I found a lot of them are no longer online, where they were online more or less as a picture other than, you know, alphanumeric text. So some of them are still not searchable.
Oh, wow.
Because of the way they stored the data back in the day. Or they might have just reformatted their drives and didn't save it.
Yeah.
The Wayback Machine's really handy. I've been able to go back and save a lot of stuff in the Wayback Machine. You know, ultimately, I would like to see something, if we could write up a treatment for, you know, we talked about years ago, there should be a movie made about it or something more long-term, like a little tiny mini-series that kind of told what happened to us in different places at different times. You know, we were in different worlds working on the same thing. We just didn't know it for a long, long time. It's a love story. You know, it was somebody that met somebody and, you know, it's our love story too. You know, we met and married, had children and, you know, and I actually had job related things with Tent Girl that, you know, it become my career, you know, so changed every bit of our lives. There's not.
Yeah, I could definitely see it as a series for sure.
But I think it'd be fascinating because it's kind of like Mindhunter in a way, because you created this, you know, database where people can be identified. I mean, it's kind of monumental and historic.
Yeah.
Well, and everybody was helping each other because they knew how to do something that somebody else, like I didn't know what HTML was. I learned how to attach a photograph during trying to actually send some of the documents to law enforcement in Kentucky, which did not have a website, but they had an email that they didn't know how to use. And I was learning how to attach a photograph to an email for the first time, which is like breathing now. And what the kids don't understand, talking to them, telling them the story. And I said, you know, we had internet that dialed up, kids. You have no idea. It's not like it is now. And when we did 48 hours, that was the first group that interviewed us. You know, I was in my 20s and suddenly the whole world was fascinated with what we did with Tent Girl. It was, you know, this thing before Doe Network even, it was, the fascination was her. When they introduced us at the first of the show, of all places, Livingston, Tennessee, and of all people, a farm boy. And I'm not a farm boy, you know, I'm not, and there's nothing wrong with being a farm boy. I'm just not. You know, we live in a rural area, but
yeah,
I've never worked. Done any kind of type of farm work at all. What most we've had is a vegetable garden, but it's just, I think for me, they were more amazed that we had a computer and we actually knew how to use it.
Oh, Lord.
That's what it felt like. And
that
I know
typical
they didn't
stereotype.
Mean,
yeah.
It was a stereotype, but they were so incredibly nice to us. But, you know, when you look back at it and you thought, they're just amazed at us dumb old people actually. You know, when they came here, they're like, they were amazed that it was not quite the backwards world that they thought, but getting past stereotypes.
Oh my God.
Was kind of hard.
They're surprised that you had shoes on, all that stuff.
Yes. Oh yeah. You know, and it's our first trip to LA was right after that. We did the Lisa Gibbons show.
It's such an amazing story. I'm so glad I came across this story. I mean, I think I read about her maybe 6 or 7 months ago. And then once we got, cause we just started our podcast back in October. So we're still fairly new to this whole world.
Who Killed Jane Doe? There was a boy and girl that auditioned to play me and Lori at a younger age. Uh-huh. And I thought, how cool is that? Because, you know, we're part of this process. And they film a lot of stuff in Knoxville for Snapped. Storm of Suspicion. They, you know, so there are people, and I'm waiting to see who can really spot this. I've literally had people walk up to me. Were you murdered on Snap last night? It's like, yeah, I was.
Wow.
And the good thing is, I don't have to think about it. I just got to lay there and be dead. That's all I got to do. It's just like, wow, this is the easiest thing. But I was comfortable on the stage. So I realized that, you know, while you're sitting there doing your interviews and stuff, they said the hardest thing was to get people to step on that set and not feel intimidated by it. Well, I had to lose that fear a long time ago. Because it was either you take your platform or somebody else is going to do it. So you had to be in charge of your own story. So being comfortable on the set, waiting for cameras to reload, change their batteries, and just being still. And, you know, I knew all the protocols. Like, you don't have to, you know, they don't have to sit down and talk to you like you're a child, you know. You just know, okay, I'm going to pause right here on this. And when we start back up, we pick it up from here. So it was kind of a natural. And it's not like a dramatic actor. It's more of a. Most of them are non-speaking, but now I do have a part in a movie coming up called Mothman 2020, and it's about a missing boy. He went missing because of that, and I will send you the link to this too, but it's a indie film. You know, it's basically they raised the money to actually shoot it, but I'm playing a cryptozoologist.
Nice.
That is very aware of studying that, so I thought, wow, I get to play a little bit. But now the missing person in the film is a boy that was, his sister is actually looking for him, and you'll see it. But the poster for him as a missing person is a Doe Network poster. So that was my product placement in that. You know, I kind of run into, I've acted with one of the actresses in the film, the lead actress. We've been in a short before. So I kind of knew her and I saw what she's doing. It's like, oh, I love this. I have to know more about this. And it just turned out a good fit, had a good opportunity, and it's not a long role, so I'm not going to have to spend a lot of time, you know, set aside for that. I can literally probably do everything I got to do in a couple of days. And we recently branded the we've always been nonprofit technically, but we did form a real 501c where we have a justice services unit. NamUs had a victim services unit that is no longer funded. You know, the funding all changed, and, you know, there's people that are not there anymore that were jobs that aren't being done. You know, it's just still working. NamUs is still a wonderful website, and we've worked on state laws to make it mandatory in some states. But still, you know, there was a need for, maybe there's funds for an exhumation or a certain type of test that's not free, or an anthropology report that might have to be hired done. You know, there was so many things. So we did the 501c, and we do have the Justice Services Unit to kind of replace. I won't have the kind of funding that NamUs had, you know, to run that unit. And it's been run by volunteers instead of paid staff. But I think we can at least start filling a little bit of that gap and at least providing something, you know, for these. And it's the first time we've ever asked for anything. Like, Doe Network's never asked anybody for anything. But I have so many people, how can I help? And then, you know, there's people that want to help that maybe have no skills to help. And it's like, well, really? Or they want to donate and I didn't have a way to accept a donation. You know, it's like, well, I really don't have a mechanism. But forgiving is a mechanism now that made it easy for me. So there's only one way to donate, and it's through that particular website. linked on the Doe Network. So it's not people trying to mail me a check or me being on the hook to have to do these monthly reports and everything that made it so difficult to have a nonprofit. Like, I didn't want to be responsible for that. And if I had money, what would I have done with it? You know, you, if we're volunteers, we're not paying ourselves. And I think I see a lot of websites that do that. They found a way to fund themselves, basically. You know, that's what they're doing. They're looking for, and that's fine. That's fine. It just wasn't my style. It just wasn't my style to do that, do it that way. If I make money on this, you know, through entertainment industry, they're selling commercials and people are watching it because they want to see it. They want to consume that particular product. You know, I feel okay with that, but not this. If somebody's going to donate money to Doe Network or to the Justice Services Unit, it is going to be 100% transparent and it's going to be applied to exactly. It might be a database improvement. You know, we've looked at a database upgrade that's basically a lot of IT work, not hardware or software, but things that we can't do. We might have to hire an expertise to take it up a level, you know, to make it easier to function. So we might have to use part of that money to hire an IT person, or maybe since we have a 501c, maybe we can get a company to donate that service. Better yet, you know, somebody can donate the IT work. So, you know, there's just lots of things that we want to do. And that's, I feel comfortable now not being with NamUs anymore because I can explore all of those things that all got put on the back burner for so long. And I'm 51. I'm not getting younger. I can't just say, hey, I'll do that in 10 years. You know, right. I can't, you know, I need to do it now. I need to do it now.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on and talking with us. And I hope this is the start of a lot more conversations, because even if we're not recording, I'm going to be emailing you a lot. So I'm just going to give you a warning.
Well, good. I hope you do. So, and I appreciate your interest. That's, we wouldn't have these opportunities if there wasn't people that are interested in what we're doing. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, we appreciate you very much.
All right. Well, I'll be talking to you a little later. I'll be emailing you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And like I said, you are welcome on anytime you want.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Awesome. I'll take you up on that. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Todd. Have a great night.
Bye-bye. All right, guys. Thank you very much for joining us for our episode of Tent Girl, Barbara Ann Heckman. We very much appreciate your time and your listens.
Yes, yes. Have a wonderful day. And as always, if you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is throughtheabysspodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat at Abyss Podcast One. Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss Podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spooky stuff.